Have you ever loved someone so much that you followed them around and talked endlessly about them to all your friends and family? That's how much we love rhododendron, a quirky and amazing genus of flowering plants with a deep human history and an incredible ecological legacy. Follow along on our adventures as we learn about the remarkable things that folks all around the world have done for the love of rhododendron. Season 2, Episode 1, A Bit of Paradise. In this episode, we meet Tom Clark, head gardener at the world-renowned Exbury Gardens. We learn how Exbury founder, the late Lionel de Rothschild, turned to gardening amidst personal disappointment, cultivating his own bit of paradise where rhododendrons are interwoven with the natural landscape to create an exotic floral tapestry. Tom shares how the crown jewels of the Exbury rhododendron collections were forged through plant exploration, hybridization, and good old-fashioned business sense, and how the focus today is on meeting the challenges of climate change and providing public access to one of the most spectacular green spaces in the UK. Reflecting the words of Lady Bird Johnson, "Where flowers bloom, so does hope." Hi, Roto lovers. Welcome back to season 2 of For the Love of Rhododendron. We're so glad to have you today. If you're new and you haven't listened before, thanks for joining us. I am really thrilled to introduce our first guest for season 2, Tom Clark, who's the head gardener at Exbury Gardens. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Juliana.
And we have as our co-host today, Connor Ryan. Hi, Connor.
Hey, Juliana, and hi, Tom.
So, Tom, you're coming to us from Exbury Gardens. Can you tell us a little about Exbury? How did it get started? What's the fun things we should see there?
Yeah, so the garden really, I mean, just to give you a bit of context, we're a sort of 230-acre woodland garden right down on the south coast of England, just in front of the Isle of Wight, sort of just to give you an idea of where we are. In the New Forest National Park, and it's a woodland garden. It was created really back in the 1920s, the sort of golden age of woodland gardening, really, when a lot of these big existing sort of country houses were busy creating woodland gardens. You know, it was the sort of tail end of the arts and crafts movement. So that sort of idea of creating a sort of romanticized woodland garden, a sort of romanticized woodland, but would never really exist in real life. But, you know, the idea of having the sort of big overstory of native oak trees and then underplanted with big drifts of azaleas, rhododendrons, sort of ponds and rockeries, cascades, you know, to try and create a sort of romanticized sort of view of the wild in your stately home garden, really. So that was how Exbury came about. It was created by Lionel de Rothschild. He was chairman of Rothschild Bank. So, you know, there's three sort of main ingredients you really need, I guess, to create a woodland garden. You know, you need a lot of space, a lot of time, and a lot of money. And Lionel had all three, really. So he created this, you know, it was really an escape for him. During the First World War, the king at the time had basically asked him not to do active service, which at the time was quite a shameful thing. I think, you know, lots of young men went off to die during the First World War from the UK. And he was asked specifically to stay at home to run the bank because the government needed the sort of wheels of the economy to keep turning. And I think that was quite a shameful thing, really, for a young guy at the time. So he moved from London down to the south coast of England, and he bought Exbury to create a woodland garden. So that's what his, you know, that was really why he bought the site. It was good for rhododendrons. He was also interested in them, and he was also keen on lots of other things that the New Forest had to offer. So he created really this great big sort of, you know, I guess his own sort of mini little bit of paradise on the south coast of England. So, you know, that's how we came about. And then it's been added to over the years. I mean, now we're a charitable trust, so we're open to the public, and we're really, you know, here to allow access to create a green space for people to come and enjoy and to preserve the collection of plants that he bred and collected. So I know that's a very long-winded answer to your question, Juliana, but that's kind of why we exist and what we're here for now, if that makes sense.
I found that how botanical gardens came to be are always long-winded answers because it's an evolution of a something. So I love that. That is very fun and exciting. It's interesting that it grew sort of at the same time when you said he had a sort of a personal disappointment. And so I know plants have carried me through a lot of personal disappointments. So I could see how that was be a joy to him.
Yeah, absolutely.
So as head gardener, what would you recommend that I see, Tom, when I go to Exbury?
Well, I mean, there's so much to enjoy in our garden, really. It's hard to sort of articulate it, I suppose, in a way. But, you know, just the natural beauty of a landscape, you know, we're in a fabulous little corner of a New Forest National Park. So we're a sort of semi-maritime climate, really. So we've got the Beaulieu River, which is a saltwater river that runs to the west of a garden, and then the Solent, which is the body of water between the Isle of Wight and the UK, is about a mile to the south. So we've got lovely views out over the water, over the river, sort of these lovely external vistas through the woods. So, you know, the actual location is fantastic. We've also got a lovely mature canopy of mature English oak trees, which kind of create the shelter that the garden was then created underneath. So, you know, we've got some lovely sort of woodland glades and views of the river. So the actual natural beauty of the area is, you know, is fantastic. But the actual then the plant collection that Lionel created, which is the sort of tapestry that sort of runs beneath the natural landscape, is lovely as well. You know, he bred over 1,000 rhododendron hybrids. Probably named about 500, ended up being named and cultivating. So we've got, you know, a huge collection of rhododendrons, and there's lots of, you know, when Lionel laid the garden out, he was very keen, you know, to work with nature. So that was very much part of the aesthetic and the ethos of the garden when he created. So we've got large wildflower meadows. We've got big drifts of wildflowers and bluebells, orchids that sort of come underneath the native oak trees. But then it's interspersed with big drifts of azaleas and the sort of more exotic planting. So it's a really lovely mixture of, you know, native wildflowers, native trees, but then all the exotic sort of layer of tapestry that's been sort of added to it. So I think when Lionel originally laid out the garden, it was very much in that sort of William Robinson style, almost trying to create a giant herbaceous border. So, you know, using the big trees that were already here as the sort of overstory, and then, you know, using the rhododendrons as, you know, the sort of mid canopy, and lots of different maples with different coloured leaves, different textures of leaves, to create that sort of lovely sort of mixture of different shapes and colours. So, I mean, it's a fantastic garden to visit. It's certainly not like a stamp collection. You know, it is beautifully sort of laid out in a very sort of sympathetic way with the natural landscape. So it really, you know, it really works well.
I think it's very hard to have a rhododendron garden that's not a woodland garden. I can't really see like a very formal style garden or any other style of garden with rhododendrons in it. It just seems to fit very well.
Yeah, it certainly does. And we're very, very lucky because our native English oak trees, you know, are probably one of the best, certainly in the UK, one of the best trees to grow rhododendrons underneath. You know, they have very deep roots, so they don't really interfere with the shallow rooted rhododendrons. And they come into leaf quite late in the spring, which means you get that lovely light early on in the year, and they have quite a high canopy, which is important. You know, they have shade, but it's sort of 50 or 60 foot up, which helps as well. And obviously the leaf litter, oak leaf litter, is perfect for growing rhododendrons, so it all kind of works together.
I'm always trying to steal my neighbor's oak leaves to put on my rhododendron beds.
Yeah, it's the best leaf mold is from oak, really, at least for us.
It's a perfect transition to our next question about the rhododendron collection you have there. I'm interested in knowing about it, of course, but also how you got it. Is it mostly from breeding? Is it from plant exploration? Yeah, anything you can tell us.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's all of those things, like lots of big gardens, really, Connor. So I think originally Lionel started off like everyone. You know, he had pretty much a blank canvas, so he bought a lot of plants from local nurseries. So Waterer's Nursery, Beach's Nursery, which was then based in Exeter. Gill had a big Himalayan nursery in Cornwall as well. So he bought plants in from you know, the great and the good of the rhododendron world at that time. So that's how he really started his collection. He pretty quickly started hybridizing his own as well. So he used, you know, some people's, you know, plants as stock plants for hybridizing. He also then, mainly in the late 20s and early 30s, started sponsoring a lot of plant hunters. So George Forrest did a lot of collecting for Exbury. So did Kingdon Ward and Reginald Farrer. So a lot of these seeds came back, and then he started. So we had a good collection of species as well, which we now don't have as much. It's quite a harsh environment where we are to grow the species. You know, we've got a very light, sandy soil and quite dry summers. So, you know, over the years, a lot of those have sort of dwindled away. But the hybrids that he created have done much better because they're obviously more suited to a wider range of, you know, stresses and strains than species. So he started hybridizing. And then, you know, really in the, I suppose, the 30s, he really got underway hybridizing his own plants using the species that he'd got from the plant collectors and, you know, crossing them back with hybrids that were already in the garden. So that formed the foundation of the sort of collection, really. And he got up to about 1,000 crosses, I think, in his original stud book. And his father had bred racehorses back at Ascot. And I think Lionel had a very similar view. You know, he was quite keen on specific characteristics he wanted to create with his rhododendron. So he was quite fussy about, you know, which parents he used. And sometimes he did the same cross in reverse to get slightly different variations. I mean, he also recreated other people's hybrids as well. So did the same cross, but with his own stock plants, just to confuse us even more. So, you know, they were very prolific. They had at one stage about 150, you know, labourers in the garden, but 70 trained horticulturalists on top of 150 workers. So, you know, they were busy in the rhododendron houses, hybridising, you know. So really, the interwar years were when they were really firing on all cylinders. So there was a lot of hybridising going on and a lot of selecting plants. He was famous for his bonfires, I think. So a lot of, you know, a lot of hybrids that didn't work or he didn't like got chucked on the fire and burnt. You know, you need a lot of space to grow on all these thousands of plants for sort of 10 years before they flower to decide which ones you want to name. So yeah, it was a mixture of other people's plants, his own, a lot of his own hybridizing, and, you know, species as well. So one of the big challenges I have is, you know, working out what is what, and, you know, whether it's a first generation plant or a second generation plant. You know, a 70-year-old rhododendron looks very much like a 100-year-old rhododendron. So, you know, trying to work out which, you know, the labeling is pretty good in the garden. I've inherited quite a lot of plant records and most things are labeled, but, you know, it's always a challenge working out what things are. And if a plant dies, quite often the label went on to the one next door, which may have been a layer of it, or a, you know, a sibling, or just one of the Grecs. You know, they raised lots of seedlings and he named the sort of best ones, but some of the siblings went out in the garden as well. I know that
very well. We have a kind of like a breeder's collection here at the Leech Research Station, and it's the same thing. It's just hybrids that David named. Most of them aren't named, and he would always plant siblings next to each other. And so, yeah, like, if as soon as you lose, like, we have this one section where one of his hybrids, Summer Glow, has just grown on top of its siblings, and so we can't really figure out where Summer Glow starts and ends, and so it's just a big mess. And it's just a fun part of figuring out what you've got.
Yeah, well, we've got a lot of that as well. But I mean, over the years, you know, it is the south coast of England is quite a difficult place to grow rhododendrons. So, you know, the more suitable hybrids have thrived, and you know, some of the others have sort of slowly dwindled away. There's a few. I mean, some of the sort of Tallinnense hybrids, it's just too hot and dry for us. So, you know, some things have just pretty much gone from a collection now, and are very hard to probably to grow now.
That is something I'm interested in hearing you talk about a little more, because I think of like the Western North, especially the Pacific Northwest of the United States and parts of England and other parts of Europe, as being like the best places outside of their native habitats for growing rhododendrons. So it's interesting to hear you say your area has become, is at least becoming harder and harder to to do it.
We're smack in the middle of the sort of bottom of the south coast of England. So pretty much anywhere further west than us, you know, they get almost twice as much rainfall as we do at Exbury. So, you know, parts of Cornwall, Devon, the west coast of Scotland and Ireland, you know, anywhere that sort of sticks out into the Atlantic, you know, is pretty much the sort of gold standard for growing rhododendrons, really. I mean, they have very little problems with anything, really. I mean, most, I think, at least in my career anyway, most rhododendron problems come back to work drainage, either not enough water or too much water, you know. And if that's right, then, you know, pretty much everything else is fairly easy, really. And we're just, I don't know, probably 50 miles, 100 miles too far east, really. And we've also got the Isle of Wight smack in front of us, which creates a little rain shadow over us, just to add to our misery. Any rain that does make its way up the channel, particularly in the summer, you know, hits the Isle of Wight and either rains on them or, you know, 10 miles inland. So, you know, we are quite dry. But, you know, generally speaking, further west than us, and then, you know, it's fairly easy. I worked in Cornwall for nearly 20 years of my career, and it, you know, we very rarely had to irrigate anything, even in the summer, because, you know, it's just enough moisture all year round. And also the humidity is another problem, which, you know, you can't recreate with watering. The air is just very dry for us. And, you know, we're on our third or second day this week of a heat wave. You know, we've got a red weather warning for, you know, risk to human health from the extreme heat we're having at the moment. So yeah, the air is very dry as well, which makes it very difficult.
Let's talk more about the hybrids that were created at Exbury.
Yes.
It sounds like what really makes them special in a lot of ways is that they're super well suited to this inhospitable growing environment. Is that one of the features that they were developed to be special for, or was the focus really their visual appeal?
I think that is just a sort of result of having, you know, grown them from over 100 years. You end up with hanging on to the ones that do well. I mean, I think Lionel's main objective was really was colour as much as anything. I think he was very keen on pastel colours, so he spent a lot of time trying to breed, you know, like a pure yellow rhododendron that wouldn't have any sort of freckles in the throat and a lot of the other. His were sort of Naomis, which are all big Griffithianum hybrids, are all sorts of lovely sort of pastely lilac colours. So I think the colour was really his main objective. But also, you know, Exbury is a big garden and a big site. So things like Griffithianum, which was quite hard to grow, certainly in the rest of the UK at the time, because it was not fully hardy, but does quite well on the south coast of England. You know, he used that as a parent because he wanted to have those sort of characteristics available, but in a tougher plant. So, I mean, hardiness was part of his motivation, I think, but it was mainly colour. I mean, he talked about, you know, creating this giant herbaceous border, and he would think nothing of getting his guys to dig up a 10-year-old plant if he didn't think the colour matched very well with its neighbour, and dig it up and move it to the other side of a garden. And quite often they had to do it two or three times before he was happy with its final location. So I think he was a pretty obsessive guy, I think. I know the current Lionel de Rothschild, when I asked him about his grandfather Lionel, he said that he was quite a difficult man, and Lionel had asked his grandmother what he was like, and she said, oh yeah, he was quite a difficult chap. He spent our honeymoon planning the menu for the next 2 years. So gives you an idea of how he viewed life. He was pretty obsessive about things, I think, and, you know, probably quite hard to work for in some ways, I guess, but, you know, very committed. And he did, you know, a lot of the work he did do himself. You know, he got through quite a lot of head gardeners. Exbury's had lots of head gardeners over the years, which I didn't realise when I started here. But I mean, certainly in the early days, Lionel really took that role on himself. You know, he pretty much was the superintendent of all the works and oversaw everything himself. And a lot of the hybridising, you know, he physically did it himself. He would come down from the bank at weekends. Although I think his weekend sort of started on Thursday afternoon and probably went through to Tuesday morning or something. So he would come down and, you know, he would spend his time actually doing the breeding and hybridising himself. So, you know, it was the sort of vision of one person, really, in the beginning at least.
I feel like visionaries are often a little, you know, they have a hard time at regular life.
Yeah, I'm sure that would have been the case. Yeah.
So it's a blessing and a curse. It's like your superpowers and your kryptonite at the same time.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right.
Yeah.
For me, when I think expiry, I think of azaleas. And so it was interesting to hear you talk about non-azaleas. You know, it's here. We have this very famous nursery now defunct near us, Gerard. They borrowed heavily from the expiry azaleas. I think we have expiry, like azaleas directly from the expiry estate on the grounds here at the Leech Research Station. There's like breeders from Alabama who cross the expiry hybrids with our native azaleas to get more adapted things. So I'm interested in hearing, about all the different, like, what was the breadth of the work? Because I'm only familiar with the azaleas, I think.
It's interesting because in the UK, we're probably more famous for our rhododendrons rather than the azaleas. I mean, the azaleas probably suit the North American climate. I mean, a lot of them will have been American, that species that they used in the first place. He bred a lot of the azalea breeding, but I mean, that went on until through the 50s as well. So Lionel did breed some azaleas, and he was particularly, but some of it was done at what he actually purchased, Waterer's Nursery, which was a big nursery in Surrey at the time. He bought that in the 1920s, or at least bought a sort of a managing sharing it. So a lot of the rhododendron, the expiry azaleas were bred at the nursery. You know, so they weren't all bred at expiry. They were done at a nursery which he owned. And also we did more in the sort of 50s and 60s. And then there was the Solent range as well, which were bred sort of more recently with other people helping us. So, yeah, there's been various different sort of generations of rhododendron breeding that's gone on. And I know, I think there was a particularly good red azalea, or very sort of, I don't know, bright, a lovely bright orangey red azalea that Lionel particularly wanted to use for hybridizing, and Gomer Waterer had it in his nursery, and when Lionel had asked him, he refused to sell it to him. So he actually bought the nursery for £1 million, I think, so he could get his hands on his hybridizing. So I mean, he wasn't a man to take no for an answer. So there's been several generations of azalea breeding as well as all the rhododendrons. So you know, it's a there's a lot of work that's been done over the past with them. Yeah.
That's hilarious. I'm just still envisioning him going, "Oh, really? Now I will have all of the plants."
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't a man to be told no, I guess, and had the resources to do it. So yeah.
That's cool. So we talked to David Millay on season one, episode 4, about Millay Nursery's hybrid conservation, and he mentioned expiry. You have anything you want to share about that effort from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, one of the great things about the horticultural industry is all the people you get to work with and meet, all over the world, like you guys. But David has, you know, he's been the chairman of a rhododendron chameleon magnolia group in the UK for a long time, and he's a fantastic grower. He's also a really nice guy. So, I mean, I've known David for quite a few years, and he's been helping us propagate, you know, a lot of the sort of crown jewels of the collection, the rhododendrons that we're really worried about. We do some in situ propagating, but at one time, expiry had the, you know, all of the sort of infrastructure and all of the technical know-how. You know, we had a huge, great nursery, and we, you know, did it all in-house. But over the years, the nursery side of things has dwindled away, really. So we don't have a commercial nursery anymore. So my job really is just to manage the collection and maintain the garden. So in a way, it's easier to work with experts like David than to try and do it all in-house. And I mean, that's great. That's part of the fun as well, is working with people like David. So David helps us. We send scions up to him, and he either grafts them or sometimes roots for us cuttings, depending on what plants they are and when he wants them. So we've been doing that for probably 15 years, maybe longer now. So David's been helping us conserve the plants, and which is great because the for plants that we want, we get to buy back off him. And so that's good for David. But it also means that a lot of the plants go into commercial production as well. So, you know, but the material we give him, he's welcome to sell, as well as giving us first refusal of having them back in the garden, which means that our plants, you know, the best way to conserve plants is to get them grown by as many people as possible. So, you know, they get sold through his nursery as well as us having the plants, which is great. You know, we're not precious about that sort of thing. We're very keen for people to enjoy our rhododendrons and get them out in the world as well. So that works really well. And David, yeah, he's one of the best growers in the UK now. So he does a really good job for us.
I drool over Millet nurseries. I just am like, oh, so yeah, jealous.
David's fantastic, and he's very very happy. He doesn't need to grow, he doesn't need to grow big numbers of anything to make it sort of commercially viable. He's on a small enough scale to help us propagate the plants we want and be able to accommodate us. So, you know, we're very lucky to have him quite close by, really.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
One of the things, talking about like conserving historic collections, one of the things I was talking to Juliana about a couple of days ago was like, we kind of are like the ones who, we have this historic leech collection. And when we decide not to propagate something anymore, that means it's going to go away. And so it's this funny position we're in about deciding which cultivars or which selections to keep going and which ones to just decide we don't need anymore. Do you run into that at all?
We do. I mean, partly identifying, making sure we know actually what we've got and making sure we're propagating the ones, you know, but we've only got one or two left of. But I mean, it is difficult. It's like all these things, you know, it's in the grand scheme of things, you know, if that one rhododendron hybrid that was bred 100 years ago falls out of cultivation, you know, it's not the end of the world. No one's life depends on it. It's, you know, it's not like an extinction in the wild. But then from our point of view, you know, part of our sort of moral responsibility looking after these plants is to keep them going. And, you know, it's part of our sort of social history and horticultural sort of culture in a way. So, you know, it's important horticulturally to keep them alive. But, you know, at the same time, you know, no one's life sort of depends on it. So it is a bit of a trade-off. And also, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, certainly, you know, a garden like Exbury, we're also, you know, we are a visitor attraction. You know, we need to, you know, there's lots of other things we have to do. We're not a botanical garden in that sense, you know, so we need to make sure that the garden is maintained well and looked after properly. And we're giving people reasons to come back and enjoy the garden. So, you know, the conservation of the collection is really important part of my role, but, you know, it's part of the sort of overall context of what we've got to do, I suppose.
Sure.
I think that's a good entry to my next question, which is about the record heat wave you guys are experiencing this summer. I think that's probably the worst, most difficult time to be a head gardener and making sure the plants are looking beautiful for visitors. So can you talk about the challenges you're facing in terms of climate change and potential solutions?
Yeah, I mean, we are, you know, we're witnessing climate change in sort of in real time, really, and certainly in Northern, I know you guys have been suffering from a heat wave as well, but Northern Europe is absolutely roasting at the moment. You know, we've had the highest ever temperature recorded in the UK a couple of weeks ago, over 40 degrees, which has never happened before. And this weekend, we've got, you know, temperatures well up in the high 30s for 3 or 4 days, very little let up in the evening. You know, it goes down to about 25 at night. So, you know, the stress on plants is, we're in uncharted territory, really. We've been complaining and worrying about climate change. And, you know, our average rainfall normally on a normal year hasn't changed that much. The way it falls has changed dramatically. So we're getting very wet winters and very dry summers, which is a change. But this year we're nearly 80% down on our annual rainfall up till now. So, I mean, we've never seen anything like that before. So we're absolutely cooking. You know, it's I would say it's Mediterranean temperatures for the last sort of month or so now. So, you know, it's not just for rhododendrons that are being stressed out in this sort of temperatures. And also, you know, plants stop photosynthesizing just to stop transpiring so they can hang on to a bit of moisture, and then they just go into a sort of terminal decline, really. So, it's pretty serious. It's hard to know really how bad it's going to be until it rains. And there's no forecast for the next 3 or 4 weeks. We're going to have the same, pretty much zero precipitation for the foreseeable future. So it's very hard to know at the moment what we're going to end up with at the end of this dry spell. I mean, we can irrigate the garden. We've got a borehole and a big reservoir, so we've got pretty much unlimited groundwater, so we can get out and water. So we're doing our best to sort of prioritize and keep things going. So yeah, it's hard to tell. I mean, we have in the past, you know, spent a lot of time trying to improve our irrigation, which is, you know, probably the one biggest thing that we can do. But I mean, in the long term, obviously pumping thousands and thousands of cubic meters of water around to keep a collection going may not be the best use of what water we've got. I don't know. We've certainly tried, you know, we grow our overstory. We're planting lots of trees. We've lost a lot of oak trees. I mean, again, through climate change and stress over the last sort of 10 years, a lot of our mature trees are going. So we've been planting a lot of different species for the overstory. So lots of limes, tilias seem to do really well in our climate. So we've got lots of tilias, things like Fagus orientalis, which is pretty much like our native beech, Fagus sylvatica, but it just comes from Central Europe and sort of Asia Minor, really. So it's just copes with a continental climate a bit better, but is genetically almost identical. So in terms of its ecology, it's still good for our wildlife. It's just a tougher plant. So we are trying to improve the sort of overstory of, and you know, we're doing a lot more mulching than we used to keep things moist, and changing the way we work. You know, we've been getting rid of grass around trees and mulching around all the big trees right out to the sort of drip line to preserve all the small feeder roots. So, you know, there's certain things we can do, but I mean, most of that isn't gonna mitigate the sort of heat we're having at the moment. So yeah, we are in sort of uncharted waters really. So it's difficult to know where we'll end up with it. Yeah, which is quite a depressing answer. I'm sorry about that.
One of the things because we're having similar issues, and I mean, we're in a place, part of the world where we can't even grow most of the rhododendrons anyway. So it's we're just trying to make do with what we can grow. And we've started to look into grafting rhododendrons onto more adapted rootstocks, and have just not really any solid data, but just from experience, it seems to have really helped and get away with growing a lot of poorly adapted things on better roots. I'm wondering if you guys, you talked about David Millay doing grafting, if any of that is with climate change in mind.
I mean, it's not something we've been doing so much in the past, but certainly, I mean, things like hyperephrum is a very tough rootstock. I know the guys in Japan have been growing rhododendrons in parts of the world, you know, that get particularly high summer temperature, and had quite a lot of success with hyperephrum. I mean, I know the Incaro rootstock as well, which was developed in Europe, apart from being sort of more lime tolerant, is also a lot more drought tolerant. So, I mean, it is tougher. So, I mean, a lot of the big commercial nurseries, especially on the continent, have been trying to improve the sort of rootstocks. I mean, in the long term, that's certainly a possibility. But, you know, when you've got sort of 230 acres of existing plants that you need to look after, it's quite hard to know what the best thing to do is. But certainly in the future, I think, you know, rootstock, we've spent the last 100 years, you know, looking at the top half of rhododendrons in terms of flowers and leaves. I think if we want to keep growing them in the future, we're going to have to spend a lot more time concentrating on what's going on below ground, because that's probably what's going to, you know, be the difference between being able to grow them and not, to be honest. Because, you know, if this becomes the new normal, then we're going to have to seriously look at how we do things, I think.
I think I agree, it is pretty depressing, but there's some good news on that front. We've done a little bit of work on rhododendron roots, and what we found is they're actually more diverse than the leaves. So that bodes well for breeding and climate change. There's some variation out there. And so, yeah, I think roots are a great frontier to think about in terms of climate change. The other good news is that even the Pacific Northwest had this last year, and people were, I think, surprised about how well their plants did do. I think for the most part, people did not suffer catastrophic losses. There were spot losses and the plants looked terrible, which is bad when you have expiry gardens because people want to see beautiful plants. But I feel hopeful that their stress tolerance will allow them to survive these things as long as they don't come too frequently. That's scary thing.
Yes, I hope so. I mean, I'm sure you're right. I mean, there's a lot of, just in our collection, you know, there's a huge amount of genetic diversity. There's, you know, some species, lots of different hybrids. So some will certainly fare better than others, I'm sure.
Rhododendron ponticum is going to be just fine, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure that'll be okay.
Do you guys have any, do you have any connection? So listeners who may not know, rhododendron ponticum and hybrids thereof have become quite problematic in the UK. Does expiry have any connection to that issue? Have you run into it? Have you run into guests that are mad at rhododendrons?
Yeah, occasionally people don't really understand, I think. You know, one of the things with rhododendron ponticum, I mean, it is a pest, and it's, you know, it grows wild in a lot of our woodlands and in our national parks. But I mean, mostly where it grows, it was planted, so it hasn't just escaped from collections and gone rampant like some plants have. You know, these big old English estates planted thousands and thousands of ponticum plants as game cover for pheasant shoots and things like that. So we took it into our woodlands, and it's just done particularly well. So, you know, it's not as invasive as, it's just thrived in sort of cool, damp woodlands. So, you know, it's escaped, but, we did help it on its way. So, yeah, no, some people, when we're busy trying to water and keep our rhododendrons alive, they say, oh, gosh, we're, you know, just up the road, we're driving bulldozers and pulling it out by the ton. But, I mean, it's a slightly more nuanced argument than people think. And, you know, ponticum was also used a lot as rootstock for grafting in the old days. So quite often we've got chunks of ponticum spring up in the garden from old rootstocks. So it's not quite as public enemy number one as people think it is, although it is bad for our native ecology, definitely.
Yeah, I find that people often want to blame the plant, and the plant is just a winner when you look at an evolutionary perspective, yeah. Right? It's just doing great. It doesn't have any ill will. It's just growing.
Yeah,
and exactly. I love hearing you say that it was people that planted it, because it's like, well, it sounds like our fault.
Yeah, no, it is definitely our fault. It hasn't really escaped in the way that people think it has. You know, it was deliberately planted. It's just thrived, really.
That's awesome.
For sure, here in the United States, people just seem to get so hooked on gardening and plants, maybe because they couldn't do anything else during the pandemic. But is that something you experienced at expiry too?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yes. I mean, our visitor numbers have almost doubled, really, in the last 2 years. So expiry, although we're in a lovely little corner of a New Forest National Park, we're actually, you know, about half an hour away from Bournemouth, which has got a population of, I don't know, nearly 500,000, and Southampton to the east of us is about 250,000. So, you know, there's a big population on our doorstep, and our visitor numbers have almost doubled in the last 2 years. But also, interestingly, the demographic of our visitors has changed. You know, we've had lots more young people, just groups of young people, you know, young 20-somethings just going for a walk with their friends, which you would, you know, was a real rarity sort of 3 or 4 years ago. So, you know, lots of younger people visiting the garden, and the way people are visiting has changed. You know, people stay for longer, so bring picnics, families come out for a whole day and bring a picnic with them and spend more time here. So, you know, that's been a real plus for us. And just generally in the UK, I mean, the Horticultural Trade Association thinks that there's 3 million new gardeners in the country. I mean, whether that can be true or not, I'm not sure. And about half of those are under 45. So, you know, there is a whole new generation of people that have discovered plants and are interested in horticulture more generally, which is a fantastic thing and a huge opportunity for the horticultural world, really. You know, things like Gardener's World, our sort of the big national TV program on the BBC. I mean, their visitor figures, obviously during lockdown, went through the roof. You know, they almost doubled, I think. So there has been a lot more interest in horticulture generally. And, you know, that certainly bears out with our visitors, which is, you know, is fantastic. Because part of our job is what we've discussed already, you know, sort of conserving the plant collection and curating this sort of historic woodland garden and the historic landscape. But, you know, beyond that, part of our job is just to provide a green space for people to come and enjoy and to allow access to it. So, you know, we've created new river walks. We've put in a new boardwalk and nature trail in a part of the woodland that there was no public access to before. We've also created a new wildlife pond at the top of a garden specifically for sort of dragonflies and aquatic insects, with little pontoons where you can go out and see all the insects emerging, and a little information shelter with sort of information on ecology and things like that. So apart from the sort of horticultural side of things, you know, just providing access to, you know, green space and allowing people to get out and enjoy, you know, being in the fresh air, really, is also a really important part of what we do, and something that we're very keen to do. You know, we're a horticultural charity, so we exist to, you know, allow people to access this little part of the world and enjoy their time, really. So yeah, that's been a real plus. And I think, you know, more broadly, horticultural students, our local college which we work with, you know, they've seen quite a high increase in people taking up horticulture to study, you know, professionally, as well as all the the actual horticultural trade selling more plants and people growing more things. So yeah, generally, I mean, that's been really positive, and hopefully that will stay with us.
Yeah, I hope so. What makes me so nervous now is it's, you know, we have really bad inflation and gas prices are so high. I'm worried that it's going to take a dip now because people are out and doing things and they can't afford it the way they, well, I don't know if they could have, I guess they probably couldn't have afforded it so well in the pandemic either, but I just hope it keeps going because it's exciting. Yeah. And I want more people.
Well, yes. I mean, I think there will certainly be an element of it. Not everyone will stick to growing their own vegetables or their window boxes, but I think, you know, once people have discovered plants, it does become part of your sort of life. So I'm fairly confident that trend will stay with us to a certain degree anyway.
Yeah, I've begun to wonder. I had plant blindness when I didn't know about plants really until I moved out to the country and I like discovered plants. I'm wondering if plant blindness was partially helped by the, like, once I saw them, there was no going back.
You can't unsee them, Juliana.
You can't unsee them. And so I think a lot of people just saw them for the first time. And so, yeah, I don't think that genie's going back in the bottle. I like the way you touched on how you're helping to be a green space, because I think about, there's a lot of people that I think are interested in plants and horticulture, but they don't have gardens of their own. So just getting connected to your local plant, you know, nonprofit and attending and being a part of that, I think, to me, I feel like that's gonna hang around. And I think younger people actually care more about plants than anyone in the past I've ever met. It's like there's this huge, just a view of plants as a solution, you know, they're a solution, and that's not going away. That is, you know, what it looks like in the future. Does it look like people, you know, planting their own home gardens in a big way? I don't know, but I think people have seen them and they can't unsee them, as you said.
Yeah, no, I'm sure that's true. I agree completely.
Yeah. So Tom, our last question is, we want to know a little more about you. How did you get into horticulture? How did you get to Exbury? What's your take on rhododendrons outside of work? And then, you know, hobbies, interests.
All right. Okay. Yeah. I'm you can't see the state of my office from my webcam, but I mean, I'm completely dyslexic. So my handwriting is terrible. And, you know, I left school with no qualifications, really didn't have any idea what I was going to do. I was just very lucky that I had supportive parents, really. And I've always been obsessed with natural history, being outdoors. And I just wanted to do something outside, really. I didn't want a boring office job. I didn't really have any qualifications. So my mum sent me to volunteer at the local National Trust property, which was just up the road from me, you know, just to try and, you know, I couldn't stay at home and do nothing. And when I got there, I just didn't realise you could even do horticulture as a career. It wasn't really anything I'd ever considered or been told about. Or, you know, when I went to see the careers advisors, they just You know, certainly in the UK, if you, you know, if you're not good enough to do A levels and then go on to university, you've just basically got to go and get a job and good luck to you, sort of thing. So when I started to volunteer in the garden, actually an apprenticeship came up. They'd been awarded an apprenticeship, but they didn't have any applicants. Nobody was applying. They couldn't find anyone to do it. And I didn't actually have enough qualifications to be signed up. But because the head gardener was such a nice guy, he basically managed to pull a few strings, and they said, okay, well, because I didn't have any maths or English qualifications, so they wouldn't let me onto the course, but they finally gave in just because they couldn't find anyone else. And as soon as I was at college, you know, I found it easy. When I was studying something I was interested in and enjoying, I suddenly found it easy, you know, and I got through the college course fine. I did an apprenticeship with a National Trust, and then I've worked in various different, mainly historic gardens all over the country, and ended up in Cornwall about 20 years ago. And that's really when I became interested in rhododendrons. You know, that's part of the sort of Cornish woodland gardens. And I joined the Rhododendron Chameleon Magnolia group because I wanted to learn more about them. And that's how I got to know, it was John Anderson, who was the previous head gardener at Exbury. I got to know him through the rhododendron group, and I went on several trips to the Himalayas with him eventually to look at rhododendrons, which, you know, was funded by the RHS. And, you know, that really, you know, changed my life, I suppose. You know, it allowed me to, you know, instead of just trying to, you know, grow plants in a garden, seeing where they want to grow in the wild, and, you know, how half of them are epiphytic, and seeing them growing on the tops of other trees and all sorts of things. So, yeah, a couple of trips to Arunachal Pradesh in northeast India really opened my eyes. And, you know, things like opportunities like that change your life, really. So it was really on the back of that that I became really obsessed with rhododendrons afterwards. Before, it was just a sort of, it was a way of getting some funding, really, was to say I was interested in them. But when I finally got to the Himalayas, that really changed everything. And since then, I was lucky enough when John moved up to Savile Gardens to work for the Royal Parks. They offered me the job at Exbury. So I never intended to be I'm not a rhododendron expert, but I never really intended to be considered an expert or anything like that. You know, it's just how things happen, really. So I've been very lucky in my career, really, and worked in some fantastic gardens, but it was all just really, you know, in the UK at the time, I mean, it's a little bit better now, but the horticultural industry is, you know, is short of people that, I suppose, of head gardener material. Lots of people will come and cut your grass and trim a hedge for you. But, you know, trained horticulturalists, we don't produce very many in the UK. And so you are almost sort of pushing an open door, really. There is a shortage of us. So I've been quite lucky. So that's how I ended up at Exbury, really. So, yeah. And outside of work, I don't know. I'm one of these weird people that's carried on doing all the stuff I did as a kid into adulthood. So I'm still a keen skateboarder. I have to go about 6 o'clock in the morning to avoid all the teenagers at the skate park so they don't bully me.
It's how bullying. Fun.
Yeah, so I'm a keen skateboarder. I like fishing as well. Still do a lot of fishing when I can, particularly fly fishing. And also I'm a mad keen surfer as well. So wow. The south coast of England doesn't really get much surf. I have to go back down to Cornwall and Devon for that. Although in the winter, we get a big swell comes up the English Channel, it's okay. So, yeah, that's the sort of thing. My kids refuse to come to the skate park with me because they're too embarrassed. So,
oh, my God. You've
been surprised how many middle-aged people are at the skate park at 6 o'clock in the morning.
It seems like it would be good exercise, a lot of core strength, basically.
Yeah. No, it's good, especially if you're the big sort of old school pools is what I really like, the big bowls where you can drop in and go around at sort of 100 miles an hour. I try not to get any of my wheels off the ground anymore. I don't want to break any bones in my late 40s.
Yeah, so what's your best trick right now?
Oh, I don't know. I'm still, I really like the old sort of 1970s style sort of pool riding, you know, sort of dropping in a big bowl and then flying around a bit like the Wall of Death, really.
When I watched the skateboarding Olympics, did you watch the news?
Yeah, that's another thing going off topic. But along with horticulture, skateboarding has had a massive resurgence since being in the Olympics. You go to the skate park at 8 o'clock in the morning and it's full of 40-year-old men trying to rekindle the magic. Well, not just men and women as well, trying to relive their glory days. So, yeah.
I was just horrified that we had to watch them hit the cement so many times. I really wanted there to be like some cushioning or something. And everybody says, oh, that's normal. I was like, I don't want to watch this.
it looks worse than it is because it's kind of transitional. So you're falling with the slope a little bit. So yeah,
not too bad. You probably develop your falling skills as your first.
Yeah, as the better, you know, the better you get, the better you get at falling off. Yeah. But it's like all these things, you're never not scared, because the more you improve, the just more dangerous things you end up doing. So you never get to the point when you're not nervous, really.
So it's just like rhododendrons.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to get this harder species. We've never grown this one before.
Or I've killed it already. Let's get it again.
That's right. Awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Tom. We really had fun talking to you about this. Now I feel sad that when I've been to the UK, I did not make it to Exbury. So it's definitely on my list.
Yeah, you must come. Come soon before it's all shriveled up completely.
yeah, absolutely. And I hope it does cool off quickly, though, and you start getting some rain. Fall's not too far around the corner. So.
No, I mean, October usually is a pretty wet month for us. So, you know, potentially September can be quite hot and dry in the UK. So I don't know. We'll have to see. But, you know.
Fingers crossed, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
knock on rhododendron wood.
Yeah.
All right, Tom. Great. Well, we're going to sign off. And thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
To talk to you again.
Yeah.
Curious to learn more about the topics discussed in this episode? Visit our website at www.rhododendron.org. Here you'll find tons of rhododendron resources, including tutorials, blogs, events, databases, and more. Click on the podcast link on the homepage to find more episodes, suggest a topic for a future episode, and get in-depth information about the people, places, and plants featured here. Until next time, keep carrying that torch for rhododendron, and don't forget to talk endlessly about this podcast to all your friends and family.